Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, have you fasted? I have. I went through some days of just water fasting. It was quite an experience. And I'm glad I did. And that's wonderful if we can do some fasting. And certainly it's very current now to do intermittent fasting. And hopefully you're doing some of that. But that's the body. Maybe we can also fast our mind. Shut it down for a while. Give it a break. And maybe we should do that regularly. How about intermittent mind fasting? We need to learn how to do that better. And to help us do that, because it's not easy, it's a job to, let's not call it a job, it's an opportunity to let go and relax our minds. And in order to do that, we have an author of a book called Fasting the Mind, and he was on the show recently talking about enlightenment. So now that we're enlightened, maybe we can fast our minds better. This is a spiritual exercise for a psychic detox, and the author is our guest again, Jason Gregory. Jason, welcome.
How are you, Peter? It's great to be back on.
Yeah, I'm so glad that we could talk about this because I think this is a journey of mind fasting that has been on the books for thousands of years.
Yep.
Still on the books. You've just written one. And it's so good to hear more about it so that we can apply ourselves to it better. So
yeah, exactly.
Thank you for writing it. Yeah.
Thank you. It's been in all the classics throughout time, but it's never really been, I guess, languaged as, mind fasting or fasting the mind. The first sort of evidence that we see of that term is in the Zhuangzi text, where there's a story where Zhuangzi, he uses Confucius as his own mouthpiece, as a sage of the time, and Confucius's disciple is Yan Wei, and Yan Wei wants to reform a ruler in the west of China, and this ruler is, very, he uses the people, he takes advantage of them, he's gluttonous, and Yan Wei wants to transform this ruler, and he has all of these schemes and all of these plans, and Confucius shoots them all down in the end. And then Yan Wei doesn't know what to do. Then he's like, what do I do? Then Confucius said, you must fast. And then Yan Wei said, well, I fast all the time. I don't drink wine sometimes. I have fasts from meat and stuff like that. And then Confucius says, that's only the fasting of the body. That's not the fasting of the mind. So you first see it in that text where that's actually translated from Chinese into English. But it's much more ancient tradition. Not saying that the Zhuangzi is not ancient. That's in the Warring States period of China. But before that, even going back into the Vedic civilization, I guess all I've done really with this is as I've formulated it from using a lot of those ancient traditions and made it more palatable for the modern mind without a lot of the mystical concepts and stuff like that a lot of people get lost in if they don't quite understand them.
Well, you've also positioned it in relationship to the Western mind and how our Western minds are different from the Eastern mind. And you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Well, if we look at the evolution of human cognition, if we go back into... Well, first of all, we're sort of under this hypnosis that... cognitively, we're all the same. Both Easterners and Westerners and indigenous cultures are all the same, and there's this one universal way of thinking. And this is completely not true. And this has been the research has explained this, especially in cognitive science and psychology. So when we go back into history and we look at this, we look at two of the great civilizations, the Greek and the Chinese civilization, that existed about the same time. If we go back far enough, if we go back to 2000 BCE until about 500 BCE, you get you get this, both of these massive civilizations, and they both evolve differently due to environmental factors. For example, in the West, in Greece, I should say, which spawned Western culture, we have in the Greek civilization, you had mainly the main source of food and obtaining food was hunting, herding, and fishing. And so when we look at the Mediterranean and the Greek civilization, you have, you know, small bands of people all along the Mediterranean. You don't really have large clusters. So the way that they, you know, obviously herding, hunting, and fishing are very individualistic tasks that you can do just in small groups and all by yourself. And so that was the environmental factors in the West. But then when we look over in the East and we look at the Chinese culture, and also if we look in the Indian civilizations, the main source of food was rice, and rice cultivation takes, you know, you and I, Peter, we couldn't do it by ourselves. It takes a lot of people. It's a big collective task. And so because of those environmental factors, the cultures, the philosophies and that was spawned in those parts of the world in the East have a very much more holistic way of thinking, while over in the West, you know, the religions and so forth and so on are far more individualistic. It's not to say that one is either better than the other. The point is that, you know, Western culture and Eastern culture are fundamentally, the perception, the way how that we both see the world is fundamentally different from each other in many regards, because we grew up with this big evolutionary accumulative cognitive style that we from way back then that we have now, and this affects the way we see the world still to this day. And in the book I explain, through a lot of research that's been done actually in psychology, and if you read my book you'll see that there's, especially even if you look at the front cover, there's a big fish and there's a picture of a big fish and a lot of coral and small fish in the background. Now this research in psychology is they ask Westerners first, you know, what do you see? What stands out to you? And so when the Westerner looks at it, there's a big bog. In this picture, there's a big bog fish. And so everyone says, you know, the fish, of course. And then when they ask the Easterners, one of this research was done with mainly Chinese, Japanese, and Koreans. And they start to describe the background. They start to describe the little fish in the coral in relation to the big fish. And so a lot of the research then explains, you know, from if we look back at holistic philosophy and perception as opposed to individualistic, the Easterners, they start to describe, when they see things, they describe more relationships, relationships and context, I should say. And Westerners will describe categories and objects, things that stick out. So these are two different styles actually of perception that actually influence the way that we think, influence our philosophies and our religions. And you know, this goes very deep, and a lot of people don't consider it because we just haven't been thinking about it in these terms. You know, we just think Easterners are a certain way and Westerners are a certain way, but deep down we all cognitively think the same, and that's not really the case, because you know there is this difference where Easterners will describe, you know, relationships, context, and Westerners will focus on more on categories and objects.
Right, and we see historically that the Western world is more into compartments of nation states and structures that aren't necessarily holistic, and actually I've done shows having to do with the Mayan calendar that have shown that the last 360 years we've been in a Western world of mind building, you know, these Western empires that are now crumbling because of greed and corruption, because it's not holistic, because they're only compartmentalizing and missing very important points of reality that keep us in whole. And so Now we're going into a time of the next 360 years where we have to rely more on the Eastern mind, on holistic thinking, on seeing the big picture and going within to find wisdom to work with it. And so it makes sense now that we're even talking about learning to use our minds differently because we have to operate that way. And so getting our minds, our Western mind, out of the way is what mind fasting is really about, is getting that prefrontal cortex to calm down, also what you call the cold mind, which is, you know,
definitely
much more,
it's I like what you said, Peter, about the about how for the last 360 years it's been prominently the Western mind. And, you know, as we both know, and as the listeners know, is that politics and a lot of the religions and that in the Western world are very compartmentalized, and they do not work together, you know. And you have,
including the fields of medicine and science, you know, so many fields, they don't talk to each other and see the big picture. They're all isolated in their specialties.
Exactly. And then if we look over in the East, for if we look at, you know, Taoism or even Hinduism, there's, you know, it's more of a holistic philosophy because, you know, as you said, medicine is incorporated with morality, all of these, and science, all of these things are incorporated into one system and not really spoken about in separate terms a lot of the time, because it is a holistic philosophy if you look at the core of it. And you know, getting to the end of your point there is, you know, because we have focused too much, because the institutions and the way that our world has been designed predominantly to be Western, we have this hypersense of individuality, which is only accessing mainly one function of the mind and one part of the brain, which I speak about in the book, and you alluded to part of the mind. For the listeners, this is, it's called dual process theory, actually, in cognitive science, where you have, this research has gone on for a while, but the terms hot and cold have only since the 90s have become popular. People like Daniel Kahneman, he uses the term system one, system two. But basically what this is cold cognition is basically the slow and effortful aspect of functioning of our mind. And you find this, the cold cognition, in the prefrontal cortex, which is basically the frontal lobe of the brain. And this is where we do all of the, this is where actually the sense of I is, you know, when we think of Peter and Jason, we're actually thinking of that individual, you know, the one who can control things, like I can get a drink of water now, or I can disagree with this person. This is just the cold cognition, the prefrontal cortex. Doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It, you know, obviously that function of the mind has its use, but the problem with super individualism is we're only accessing this part of the mind, and we're forgetting about the older, more primal evolutionary part of the mind, which is the hot cognition, which is found in the more unconscious regions of the brain. And that's, you know, when you look at your hand and you open and close your hand, or you just wiggle around, or you move your body, this is all the hot cognition. And hot cognition can bring a lot of beauty to life. It's this, it brings the spontaneity of life to life. And, you know, this is the part of the brain, you know, if we look at a musician, or if we look at athletes, when we watch a sport, for example, and someone sees, I don't know, someone like LeBron James, who's having a great game of basketball, and they say, wow, he's in the zone. All that's happened there in that process is when we look at the science of the mind, he's an athlete, say like LeBron James, has actually just down-regulated the cold cognition, the prefrontal cortex, and allowed his more instinctual and spontaneous nature, the hot cognition, to take over. Obviously, to learn a lot of the things he can do on the basketball court, needs to have, you know, a strong cold cognition to learn certain, you know, methods and stuff like that. But it's all embodied in the hot cognition, and then it just becomes like second nature. And so, the problem in our world is we've lost contact with this hot cognition, and we're overtraining the cold. And, you know, you see big problems in super intellectual countries, like, for example, in Korea. You might have, you know, in Korea, for example, in high school, they'll make students go to school from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. during the day. So that's a lot of time at school, cramming in a lot of information. And what's happening is, because that they are doing a lot of this, they're doing a lot of cold cognitive work, like, you know, trying to study, trying to remember certain things, a lot of trying to, all of this, trying to access too much memory and trying to, you know, cram in too much information, is leading to a lot of mental health problems in places like Korea. And this is why, you know, teen and actually child suicides are some of the highest in the world in Korea. And, you know, panic, not to mention panic attacks and depression and so forth and so on. So this all comes from overstimulating the cold cognition, trying to, you know everything, trying to be a specific person, and trying to, you just, it's using, because it's the cold process, it's an effortful part of the mind. So it's, when we look at the body, it's actually physiologically expensive to use too much of the whole cognition. And this is why people do have nervous breakdowns and depression, because they are actually running against nature than running with it. So when I say running I mean
it's really balance.
Yeah, it is. It is, Peter. It's about finding balance. And, you know, what I was about to say is, if you don't allow that hot cognition to naturally do itself, to play its function, like, you know, you and I, we can go for a walk in nature and enjoy the peace and quiet and have a good conversation without thinking too much. These things are very relaxing to the nervous system, to the mind. But if we don't have that time, and we just we're in a cold, effortful process all day or every day, then, you know, we're depleting our nervous system, and we're actually killing ourselves. You know, that's right. Not just, so, and I mean literally.
So let's come back to fasting the mind and understanding that, yes, we need a mind. We do need to operate in the world, but our minds are over-conditioned to be fearful of the future, be fearful of what we don't know, but we can only know what we know. And if we try to know too much, like these students in Korea, you end up losing the big picture. And so how do you find the difference? And, you know, we go back to, for instance, the Bhagavad Gita and the story of the warrior prince Arjuna, who had just received a great lesson of life from Krishna, who was his chariot driver, turns out to be Krishna, and all of a sudden understands this, you know, the hot nature, understands, you know, greater truth, the oneness of all, and he's on the battlefield needing to go to battle, and he says, now what? Now I understand that all is one, so are both sides of the battle, so how can we have a battle? And Arjuna, and then Krishna says, you have to live the truth of your, let's call it organic self, your human design. You have to live what you're designed for. You're designed to be a warrior, so you have to go to war anyhow. And so what that says is that we really all have to live our truths. You know, you can meditate all day long, but you have to, for instance, for you, you have to be an author. So you have to live mentally in the process of, what are you going to write, and how are you going to write it, and where's the book going to go? All that stuff that you need to know, but it has to be authentically you, and you have to live in what's authentic and not try to waste, or not try to, but not wasting your energy in what's not authentic about you.
Exactly. Well put, Peter. And I like how you used the Gita as an example, because, you know, this is a perfect example. Arjuna, if we look at the cognitive science perspective, you know, him as the cold, rational self, the ego, if you want to call that, was analyzing too much about what was happening and so forth and so on. I know that they, you know, obviously in Indian philosophy, they like to take things very far. So they used a very dramatic landscape using a war and him right. against his friends and so forth and so on. But the point is, Krishna's point in that is that, like what you said, it's about following, you know, in Vedanta, they would say following your dharma, which means kind of your virtue or what your innate virtue that brings, you know, light into the world. And that's different for each and every one of us. And that's more related to the hot nature, you know, so bringing this organic, authentic self into the world. It doesn't mean that, you know, for people who's listening, it doesn't mean you go into war with your family. It's more of a metaphor about when our mind is in the way, when the cold cognitive aspect of our mind is too strong and too in the way of our authentic self, our hot nature, then that's when all of the problems within ourselves and in the world begin. And we can't see, you know, we can't even look and feel the heart of others. You know, there's, for example, to articulate this point, Mencius talks about how we are innately good. Each and every one of us are innately good. But a lot of his disciples, that, you know, said, you know, that this is all not true. You know, they used Ox Mountain as an analogy. So Ox Mountain, for example, was barren, was desolate. And they said, look at the other mountains. They're all green. And they said, so Ox Mountain's nature must be bad. And Mencius said, no, that's not right at all. Look at the environment that Ox Mountain is in. Ox Mountain was close to a large country. So there was always, you know, sheep and cows going up and eating the new sprouts and this and that. So its nature was fundamentally good. The problem was the environment that it was in that was bad. Now, why I'm mentioning that is because if we look in places like, for example, in China, there was a situation with a young girl called Wang Yu, and she was a young 2-year-old girl, and I think you probably heard this story, Peter, where she ran off from her mum in the market, and a car ran over her. This is back in 2011, and the car ran over. There's CCTV footage of this, and about 10 bystanders walked past, and then they did nothing. They just looked at the girl, kept going. You know, I think she may have almost been dead at that stage. And then another car ran over her, and then another 8 bystanders walked past. And finally, an old grandma in the market picked her up, took her to hospital. Unfortunately, Wang Yu died. And they did a poll in China and asked, you know, how many people would actually do this? Because, you know, the whole world was in shock about it. And it was an alarming stat. It was like 90% of people said that they would have did the same thing. And the key point, and probably the key word in this, is cold, because they said that they would have done this because of cold indifference. And so the the psychologists studied this, this is what the rational mind or the cold cognition can do to us. If we're only training that, you know, if we're only training that and you're allowing the environment to influence you to be a certain way, to be a certain person, then you lose touch of that innate goodness that's within our hot cognition. And these sort of things can happen. And we see this is how wars begin. This is how many things begin, you know, like from small to large. So, you know, it's a big problem in the world, because we are under this, you know, I say the disillusion of the disembodied myth, where people think that the mind and body are actually dualistic, when if we look at Eastern philosophies, their fundamental core is mind-body holism. So that's where you have embodied cognition as opposed to a dualistic sort of cognition.
So it's very important, actually, to understand how our minds are affected, and how to work with them, and to build an understanding of our mind process, so that we can live more at peace with ourselves, and in the world. And so, You know, the show will be ending in a couple minutes, and this is something I want to go, if you don't mind, to go deeper in with you at a subsequent show, to talk about actually mind fasting and the process and what to expect of it or what not to expect of it.
And I'd love to do that, Peter, for sure.
And yeah, maybe we can do it next week.
We'll
email about it. Because I'm very excited about the deeper nature of living with ourselves in much more holism and peace in a world right now that's so, in many ways, torn apart, and to find that place of seeing that more Eastern awareness of reality.
Definitely. And that's like what you alluded to before, like we're coming into a transition where that sort of Eastern way of thinking is starting to infiltrate. Well, it's been infiltrating the Western world for a long period of time.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, fortunately.
But now let's use it more.
Yeah, well, fortunately, it's happening. It's happening, but it's probably not happening at the speed or the rate that I would probably like. But
right, so we'll help move it along. Your book certainly helps, Fasting the Mind. And your name is Jason Gregory. And is there a website or a place that they can go to learn more?
Definitely, yeah. You can go to my website, jasongregory.org, and you can find me on Facebook or Twitter. My Twitter is jasongregory33. And on YouTube, I have a series of a show called Enlightenment Today, which goes into a lot of these topics. So you can find that at YouTube/OneWorldWithin.
Oh, that's great. And I really am glad that we can talk. And I'm you're a role model too, because you live in Chiang Mai, and I've been there, and it's idyllic in so many ways. And you know, you have an opportunity to really be in the East and enjoy that world. So
it is. It is great. Thank you, Peter.
Yeah.
And one day, maybe, hopefully, you'll come over here.
I would love to. Jason Gregory, thanks so much for being a guest again on Energy Steel. I look forward to talking with you soon.
Thank you, Peter.
And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Steel at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.